Good morning, Teachers on Fire. Welcome back to the Teachers on Fire podcast. I'm so glad that you're here with me this morning. This is the first show of 2024. I've been traveling. I've been fighting jet lag. I've been a little bit ill. And now here we are finally back on the show. I'm so glad to be here. Today's teacher on fire is Eric Francis. Eric is an international author, presenter, and professional development provider with over 25 years of experience in education. He is the author of Deconstructing Depth of Knowledge, a method and model for deeper teaching and learning, published by Solution Tree. His upcoming book, Inquiring Minds Want to Learn, Posing Good Questions to Promote Student Inquiry, will be published by Solution Tree in spring 2024. So that's exciting. You can follow Eric on X at MaverickEDU12. Eric, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Are you ready to light it up?
I'm ready to light it up, Tim. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate you allowing me to have this time and this forum to talk with you.
Well, it's been a long time coming, as we were talking about off air. I'm so glad to finally have you on the podcast. Why don't you start by telling us a little bit more about your current context in education? What does that look like for you on a daily basis?
Well, now what I do is I provide professional development, guidance, support to schools and staff around the country, around the world now. It's now opening up again. I'm proud to say I'm going back to Singapore in April. Really looking forward to that. What I do is I work with educators, school leaders, school teachers on what I say is my why. And my why is to ensure that teaching and learning is standards-based, socially, emotionally supportive, and student responsive, so that the experience is academic and affective for all. And how I do this is I provide professional development on a concept called depth of knowledge, DOK, which we've all been introduced to and working with for the last 10 years. I use questioning and inquiry. As you mentioned, my new book is coming out in April. A lot of my focus has been on standards-driven learning, not standards-based, but standards-driven, and really looking at why we need to rethink how we understand and use standards in this modern education as a system and also as stakeholders. And really what it involves is a lot of it's writing books, it's traveling, it's working with schools. Lately, what I've been wanting to do more and trying to do more is to work with the leadership. Most of the professional development you get are these one and done professional developments where you come in for one day. And, you know, the unfortunate thing is that now more than ever, they're really not proving to be effective. We need to basically make sure that professional development is continuous and supported. So what I'm working to do is working with not only leaders in terms of administration, but the leaders who can implement the innovative ideas and methods and mindsets that I talk about in my professional development.
So good. And you dropped so many juicy topics, Eric, that I can't wait to get into. We've got inquiry and standards and depth of knowledge. But before we get into any of those, it is story time. Would you share with us about a low moment or an experience of adversity that you faced somewhere in your teaching or education journey and describe how you overcame it?
Yeah, I was an unsuccessful administrator. I didn't last long in the world of administration. I had my career path all mapped out like a lot of us. You go into teaching, you do your classroom teaching, then you become a site administrator, maybe dean of students, assistant principal. Someday you go to district office. And then maybe you'll be a superintendent, and then eventually you'll teach college or university. I had it all mapped out and planned out. I wasn't successful, and I will admit that. And a lot of that had to do with my own ego and arrogance, I think, in the position. I don't think I was ready to go to the position that I was in. I was a dean of students for 1 year, and I was an assistant principal for another year. And really, it was not a learning curve, and I was not allowed a learning curve. And it was probably a very, very miserable low point in my career because it knocked me off my career path. I've been knocked off the career path before. I mean, I didn't expect to go into teaching. That wasn't my idea. I was originally going to work in the film industry, and I did for a number of years, but I decided I didn't want to do that anymore, and that's how I got into teaching. So I was at that crossroads again. And I just had my second daughter. And then what happened was I really had to look at it. I had to look at myself. I had to look and say, is this the career path I wanted to take? Because I got into administration, I'll admit it, because you make more money in administration. But also I really bought into the whole thing about being an instructional leader. And I was anything but. And what an instructional leader means to me is that you're working with instruction, you're working with curriculum, you're working with teaching. And I was doing everything else but. I was mostly doing discipline or putting out political fires or being an accountant. So I had to make a decision because I did get another assistant principal job. And did I want to go that route or did I want to go this other opportunity, which was at the State Department of Education here in Arizona where I live? And I went that route, which is interesting because when you work for a Department of Education, it's now not education, it's government. And the great thing about that is I learned so much about policy and finance and all the things like you wanted to learn about as a suicide administrator, I learned at the state level, but now I was looking down. So overcoming that adversity, I would not have become or be or do whatever I'm doing right now with the writing of books, professional development, if I did not have that adverse time in my profession. It was a turning point. It was a good decision to go to the state. That was tough as well. It just because I could learning a lot about leadership, but someone playing in my head, hey, you should do this thing called education consulting. That was never a thought, Tim. That was never an idea. That was never a goal of mine. I'm like, what's that? You know, you want me to give up my security of my job and my pension and everything to go do this thing? So I slowly got out there and slowly, you know, did it and created this thing. I started out doing a thing called Title I consultation, helping schools set up their Title I programs and be in compliance. And then I really started to take off and become that instructional leader, presenting at conferences. And I had a couple of publishing companies come to me and say, did you ever want to write a book? And I'm like, yeah, but not on education. I wanted to be a screenwriter, a comic book writer. And so I started writing books. I wrote my first one in 2016. And then Deconstructing Depth of Knowledge came out in the fall of 2021, the winter of 2022. And now I'm on to write my third. You know, my adverse experience was actually a blessing because this would not have happened. And I am blessed to say that and grateful to say that I've been doing this now for 12 years. And I've been doing this actually as long as I was in the classroom. So it's kind of interesting how my career kind of veered in this way.
Amazing story. And thank you for sharing it, Eric. I think it takes a certain amount of courage and vulnerability to go there. But I think you give a lot of hope to educators who are at some kind of a dead end in their career. And it doesn't mean that all is lost and that you necessarily need to leave education entirely, right?
Right.
But there may be a different place for you that that works out in a very positive way. Thank you to Laura Williams on LinkedIn, who says thank you for sharing your experience. Well, let's move on in our conversation, and we're going to make a hard pivot into depth of knowledge. I want to put something up on the screen that you shared recently. If I can add this to the stage, there it is. You tweeted, are you doing DOK or depth of knowledge accurately? How are your students doing depth of knowledge? These are the actions and expectations for demonstrating different levels of depth of knowledge. So I feel a little bit threatened as a teacher by the question, Eric. I don't know if I'm doing depth of knowledge accurately. So why don't you expand on that and share a little bit more about what you mean?
Right. And thank you for allowing me to have this forum for that. The unfortunate news is that there's a lot of misinformation and miscommunication, misinterpretations about what depth of knowledge or DOK is. And it's a very, very complex concept that we can simplify if we do it accurately. What I mean by doing DOK accurately is that 10 years ago, a little more than 10 years ago, when here in the States, all the schools around the country shifted to the Common Core standards, one of the things that we were told was that these standards are different than the No Child Left Behind standards because they expect students to demonstrate different levels of thinking and demand students to understand user depth of knowledge in different contexts. Well, we all know what Bloom's was with higher order thinking, but this DOK thing was very nebulous. And we were all given this graphic that's out there called the DOK wheel. And it's completely inaccurate. And it's so inaccurate that Norman Webb, who created depth of knowledge, he refutes it. But it's everywhere. So the problem I'm experiencing is that you have this document that's out there. This document was not only given out by the state departments here in the United States to saying this is depth of knowledge, but it's everywhere. It's so false, it's become true. And if you notice lately, a lot of things I'm talking about on social media is about the concept of rethinking, which involves looking at new data and information and saying, okay, we need to reconsider why we do how we do what we do, because there's new data and research and information. So Norman Webb has come out finally with an article that's on Edutopia that says how to use Webb's depth of knowledge. And he says the DOK wheel is inaccurate. It's not about the level of thinking. It's not about the complexity. It's about the complexity of thinking. Excuse me. It's about the context. We need to ask ourselves what exactly and how deeply students must understand and use their learning to demonstrate proficiency or develop competency or perform successfully. So the graphic you put up there, I'm always trying to simplify this because this is like teaching calculus and physics to teachers. It is a very, very complex form of teaching that can be simplified once you get it. But this is not arithmetic, and this is not, you know, basic science. This is deep stuff. And what the complexity of it is that it requires us educators to look at our teaching differently, that we're not judging things or evaluating things based upon the type of thinking or the kind of knowledge, but rather the depth and extent students must understand, use their knowledge. And to make it visible with this graphic that you have up here is that what does that look like? What does DOK look like in the classroom? So what I say is at a DOK one, all you have to do is answer. Now, math teachers get very challenged by that because they give some hard math problems. And they go, that's hard. It must be a deeper DOK level. No, if I just have to, you know, apply an algorithm or conduct do a calculation or use a formula, it's a DOK one. A DOK two, you have to explain or express. So now I have to explain how I attain that answer, or I have to express my feelings and thoughts. I'd like to say DOK two is a social emotional level because this is where I tell you what I think, what I believe, what I feel, or how I can do something. At a DOK three, you're either checking, concluding, confirming, considering, or critiquing. This is described as thinking strategically and using complex reasoning. And then you have to use evidence to support your responses. And a DOK four, you're either expanding, exploring, or extending. So this is where you're going to be doing STEM in math and science, but more so of an engineering design or using scientific inquiry to address a real world scenario situation. In English language arts, you're going to be doing author studies and genre studies. And you can do that at a grade level. You can have a first grader. Everybody reads Green Eggs and Ham. And you can have the kids read another Dr. Seuss book and say, what's the common elements? That's a DOK four. In history, this is where you're looking at the impact of history on the past, the present, and the future. Art, music, PE, what's interesting is that your courses are going to be the ones that will help the core content areas of literacy and math and science and social studies, how to connect what they're learning in your classes. So using math and PE, using in history and English language arts, you're making songs from what you're reading or what you're learning about in history. That's all DOK four. So because as a system and as a profession, we are so hung up on action. What I did here with the graphic you see here, and I have a number of them. These are the verbs you need to know for DOK. Okay. That if all they have to do is answer, it's a DOK one. Okay. If they have to explain now, just because that objective says explain, that doesn't mean, oh, it's automatically a DOK two. You got to look at what comes after that verb. You got to ask yourself, okay, well, what exactly are they explaining and how deeply do they have to explain it? So if I say explain that, all I'm doing is answering DOK-1. If I'm explaining how or what's the difference or what is infer, that is a DOK-2. At a DOK-3, those are the actions they have to do. So they may have to check their answers. The simplest way to do a DOK-3 is to give the kids an answer and ask them, why is it correct or incorrect? Or in literacy courses, give them the idea and have them come up with the theme, which is the message, and have them find evidence in the text that supports that idea and message. Conclude, this is when you're doing your argumentations, concluding, critiquing, confirming, again, checking, considering, where you're really thinking critically and creatively. And DOK-4, the kids have to expand their knowledge. So they're going beyond the classroom. They're exploring what else they can do with what they've learned, or they're extending what they can do what they've learned in different contexts and deeper ways. So if we're going to get stuck on verbs, these are the verbs we need to look at. These are the actions. This is how you know that students are learning at these levels. They're either answering, which is a DOK-1, explaining or expressing, that's a DOK-2, checking, concluding, confirming, considering, or critiquing, DOK-3, or expanding, exploring, extending. And what's interesting is DOK is not about what we're doing as teachers. It's about what the students are doing as teachers. And I know I'm going through a long description, but I want to put this out there because I want teachers to understand this. We are all teaching at a DOK-2, a DOK-3, or a DOK-4. We're all teaching at that because we can explain what we're teaching. That's a DOK-2. We can consider, conclude, critique, and check why we're teaching what we're teaching is accurate or inaccurate, DOK-3. We make incredible connections with what we're teaching in our classroom. We can take it beyond the classroom. We can say, how are Brutus and Macbeth Shakespearean tragic heroes, and what are the similarities between them and Anakin Skywalker? That's a DOK-4. Or we could basically create lessons in which we turn linear and quadratic equations into football plays. That's a DOK-4. Or do a great STEM experience. That's a DOK-4. So we are all teaching at a deeper DOK level. Don't let anyone say, you're only teaching at a DOK-1, because you're not. The question I'm going to ask you is this: what's the level your students are learning? Right now, I am talking and teaching at a DOK-4 because this is extended thinking about depth of knowledge. You're all listening, and that's a DOK-1. So you really need to look at how your students are responding, because the rigor is in the response.
We've got Nyla Felix Mitchell. Nyla Felix Mitchell on LinkedIn asking, what does DOK mean? So without repeating the last 5 minutes, could you just give the maybe the 10-second version of depth of knowledge?
Yes, depth of knowledge. That's what it means. Depth of knowledge. It's a criterion for alignment studies. That's what Norman Webb created it for to do. It is a measure of cognitive rigor. That's how Karen Hess took it and did something with it. And it is also a method model for teaching and learning. That's my work with it. So when depth of knowledge, DOK, that's the acronym, because you know education, we need to have our acronyms, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So basically, that's what you're doing. And if you want to know the depth of knowledge demanded, ask two questions. What exactly and how deeply? What exactly are they thinking about and how deeply they need to think about it? What exactly must they learn? And how deeply must they learn it? That will give you the rigor of the response they have to provide and the depth of knowledge level demanded.
Speaking of rigor, Karen Hansen is on X. She says, the rigor is in the response. That is really helpful. And I like how you sort of gave teachers a pat on the back there and said, hey, your depth of knowledge, no problem. But focusing on the student learning, I find that really helpful as well. Naila says, I came in at the last minute. Yeah, no problem, Naila. We appreciate the question. Trust us, if you are asking that question, other educators are as well. Just before we move on, Eric, I think about EdTech and EdTech tools and a lot of the tools that are sort of sexy in the classroom. So many of them really don't move far beyond DOK-1 or maybe 2. Would you agree?
Completely agree, because they can't. Okay. Yeah. It's funny you say this, because I do have a thing where I talk about technology as it relates to DOK. DOK-1 is Google. If you can Google your answer, if you can Google the information, if you can Google the knowledge, GTS, Google that stuff, it's a DOK-1. Right. Now, Google is a way of life. And what we do sometimes as educators, we say, you can't use Google. Well, that's similar to saying we want you to run a marathon, but you can't wear sneakers or you can't wear running shoes. Because that's how we actually originally started running marathons. The Greeks ran the marathon barefoot. And when you say you can't use Google, that's essentially what you're saying. Google's a way of life. If I asked any teacher, what are the name of all the 50 states in alphabetical order in their capitals, probably the K-3 ones will be able to sing that song and everyone else will Google it. So when it comes to technology, when it comes to especially AI and ChatGPT, we can't make the same mistake with Google. We can't say to the kids, don't use Google. But ChatGPT functions at a DOK-2. Why? Because it can explain the answer or they can explain information in a way that basically is similar to summarization. And that's what happens at a DOK-2. You are summarizing. And I highly recommend people use ChatGPT. Look, we're going to talk about questioning probably later. And questioning is hard and asking questions is hard. And what I do, what I teach teachers is, look, go into ChatGPT. I give them a sentence frame to ask ChatGPT and it comes up with good questions. I mean, I quote the wrestler Roddy Piper, just when you think you have the answers, I change the question. And that's what's happening with AI. Just when the kids think they have the answers, we educators need to change the question. So the technology can only function at up to a DOK-2 because it can either give you an answer or it can explain the answer. So what I'd like to say is that DOK-1 is Google, DOK-2 is AI ChatGPT in its current state, but DOK-3 is HAL 9000 from 2001 A Space Odyssey, because you have to reason and you have to use emotion and you have to come up with logic deduction for it. So if you watch the movie or read the book, HAL was faced with a moral dilemma. He could not lie to humans. He was programmed not to lie to humans, but he had to lie to humans, but he couldn't lie to humans. So how did he resolve his moral dilemma? He killed the humans. Okay. The thing is that ChatGPT is not at that point. Okay. It hopefully it'll never get to that point when it has basically a human dynamic on it. DOK-4 with technology is Skynet from the Terminator movies, because you're thinking extensively. Because what Skynet said, wait a minute, we have all the nuclear codes as this technology. Why don't we just launch all the bombs? We'll destroy all the humans and the machines will take over. So we can't fear the technology. The workforce is moving towards the technology. The comparisons between what the technology is doing in the classroom with us and our kids is the same as when our grandparents said, you know what? You don't use calculators. You have to use the math this way. And our math teachers all taught us, you know, you need to learn the math this way because you're not going to walk around with calculators in your pockets for the rest of your life. Well, Steve Jobs changed that for all of us. So this is also an opportunity for us to think critically. And I also want to give a fair warning to teachers, because there's a lot of AI out there that's saying, like, for example, I saw this new one that they say DOK questions. You can click on them and it gives you the DOK questions. Well, don't just trust it. You still got to look at it with a critical lens. Use those guides I gave you, those descriptors, those verbs I gave you, to really determine whether that's the accurate DOK level or how you can make it a deeper DOK level. Because I'm seeing out there, they're like, oh, there's this new tool and this new tool, and it will create DOK questions for us. And I'm like, don't trust it. You still got to use your teacher talent, your instructional talent, to work the tools. Think of it this way. I can give you Eddie Van Halen's guitar. That doesn't mean you're going to start playing the Van Halen catalog like Eddie Van Halen. Okay. You can't. And even if the guitar has an iPad on it that sounds the Brown sound on Eddie Van Halen's guitar, you still need to use your instructional talent. Don't just rely on the machines. It's a tool. You can buy those machines in the same place you can buy a dishwasher, a refrigerator, and a washing machine. Does that control you, or do you control the tools? That's the big thing we need to know about that with AI. but don't fear it and don't stop using it.
That was well said. I really enjoyed that, Eric. That was awesome. A little bit of an AI sermon there, and we could go deeper on technology, I know, but I want to move on to this. You shared an interesting tool for teachers that appears in your upcoming book, and to be clear, I have no affiliation, nothing to gain. I just found this interesting. So the book, again, is called Inquiring Minds Want to Learn. And let me see if I can throw the tool up on the screen. So looking at this framework, I thought, could you take some time here on the podcast? And I do have to keep in mind our audio only listeners, but could you walk us through this framework, Inquiring Minds Want to Learn, starting with Hook'em right at the very top?
Certainly, certainly. And thank you for sharing that. This is actually the foundation of my next book. So the idea is, again, if the word is rethink, we need to rethink how we engage in inquiry and use questions in the classroom and questioning. Primarily what we do as educators, and we do three things. We present information, we provide instructions, and we pose questions primarily to assess. And some people may say, well, I don't. Well, that's great. But education, mostly, that's what happens. What this does is, and this is how I taught, you start the instruction, you initiate the instruction and the inquiry with a good question that will hook them. Students don't have to answer that question. They should reflect before responding. And think of the hook 'em like the teaser before the blockbuster of a movie. You know, everyone gets excited for the movie based upon the trailer. So this is the teaser trailer. So I can walk in and I can say something as complex as, so how did Edgar Allan Poe create an entire genre of literary fiction? And then the kids don't know. Most of them don't know. Hopefully someone knows and they can learn, become the teacher. And then I would say, well, what if I told you he wrote the first detective mystery story featuring a sleuth who was smarter than the police and used deductive logic and reasoning to solve a crime? I said, who does that sound like? And the kids would say, that sounds like Sherlock Holmes. And then I'd say, what if I told you that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle actually based Sherlock Holmes on a character that Edgar Allan Poe created 40, 50 years before? That's how I've hooked them. Because what I'm going to do is I'm going to take them into a deep inquiry, which is one of the pathways. And I'm going to take them into a deep inquiry into how did Edgar Allan Poe create an entire genre of literary fiction with the murders in the Rue Morgue? And that goes beyond the standard, that goes beyond the curriculum, because usually that story is not in our textbooks. So that's what I mean by hooking them. You just start off with a question. Like if I say to you, what is 2 + 2? Everyone's going to say 4. That's great. But what's the real learning? They need to explain how they got that answer. So after I say 2 + 2 and they say 4, I say, what do you mean? Or some people can say, how do you know? I prefer what do you mean, because how do you know sounds more like a challenge, but what do you mean sounds more like I'm being conversational with you and I want you to consider what you're saying. So now you have to explain, how do you know that 2 + 2 = 4? That's the deeper learning, and that's the transferable learning. So that's another way to hook them. You can also challenge their knowledge, their pre-existing knowledge, to cause them to rethink. So one of the things I do here in the States, I ask, who's the first president of the United States? And the students will say, George Washington. And I say, what do you mean? And they eventually explain he was the first elected under the United States Constitution. That allows me to go in and say, well, what if I told you there were 8 presidents that were appointed before him on the Articles of Confederation? Do you see how I'm phrasing that? I'm not just making a statement. I'm saying, what if I told you? So I'm inviting it. So I ask the question. The question replaces my learning target. It's not I can anymore. It replaces my objective. It is the question that initiates the inquiry and sets the instructional focus. After you do that, there are 4 different pathways you can go down. Foundational inquiry is about building background knowledge. And you can do that with your students' own questions. What I do with even adults is I show them either a prompt or a stimulus and I say, what does this mean to you? What stands out for you? What are you not sure about? And what questions do you have? So now that's building the foundational inquiry. The understanding pathway is standards-based. So that's where you're turning your standards into questions that set the instructional focus and serve as the assessment. Deep inquiry is where you go deep into your learning. This is where you're going to be addressing more so your important to understand and nice to know standards. and the expertise pathway to inquiry, that's where you really talk about personalizing learning. You're talking about talent development. And the easiest way to do that is to take every standard, every objective, and put three question stems in front of it. You can say, how do you? If you say, how do you? That's assessment. How do you fluently multiply multi-digit numbers using standard algorithm? That's an assessment question. How can you is instructional or places your learning target. How can you fluently multiply multi-digit numbers using a standard algorithm? How could you encourages inquiry? Because if I ask you, how could you fluently multiply multi-digit numbers using a standard algorithm, that infers and suggests there's more than one way. So that's pretty much the framework in a very big nutshell. So you hook them with a question, you start your teaching with a question, you further the conversation with what do you mean? You then use the question to set your instructional focus, serve as the assessment, you build background knowledge or foundational knowledge for the students' questions, you turn the standard into a question for understanding, you engage students in deep inquiry, and then you have inquiry for expertise where the student gets to express and share their learning in their own unique way.
Thank you so much, Eric. I know I was asking a lot there, and I know we need to sign up for the full workshop to get the step-by-step work through, but that really gets me thinking, and I see the connections with DOK in this framework, so that really helps me think through my practice as a teacher. Thank you for that. Let's move on to standards, another big topic that I wanted to hit in this conversation. I know that you believe in the power of standards-driven learning. Why is it so important, do you think, for instruction and learning activities to be always connected to standards?
Because we really need to rethink. Again, I'm going to use that word again, rethink how we use standards. Traditionally, we view standards as that thing we need to teach, and that's what we test the kids on. That's not the purpose of standards in this post-pandemic world, where now it's brought forth some issues where we talk about learning loss. Learning loss is a real concept. It's funny you said sexy before, because I like to say that sounds sexy, because I can get on a pulpit and I can get on a podium. I can go, there's learning loss. If I said there's gaps in learning, it's kind of like college and career readiness. That's sexy. SEL is sexy because you can sell that. It's like advertising. What I like to compare it to is there's a great line in Jaws, my favorite line in the movie Jaws. It's when after Chrissy, the swimmer, is attacked, and Sheriff Brody goes out on the barge and he's with the mayor. And the mayor says, Martin, it's simple. You shout Barracuda, people say, huh, what? You say shark, we got a problem on the 4th of July. That's kind of the thing what's happened, is that we've really misunderstood and we've really misinterpreted and also mischaracterized a lot of the great stuff we use out there in education. So the big thing is that if there's learning loss, and we've brought learning loss to the forefront to say it's a pandemic thing, which it's not a pandemic thing. Learning loss is inherent in education. Summer vacation causes learning loss. Bad scheduling causes learning loss. Bad teaching causes learning loss. But we don't want to talk about Fight Club. Bad times causes learning loss. When was your learning loss as a child? Mine was third and fourth grade. My parents got divorced. I still struggle with those concepts. My world was falling apart. You think I really cared about multiplication and fractions? Or middle school, where I didn't really have some great supportive teachers? Or high school, when my friends were making destructive decisions and I, kind of got upset and had some serious things where I had to go to a private school, because we didn't have school choice back then in the 80s. You either went to your district school, a military school, or a religious school. So I chose the religious because my mullet looked like Mel Gibson's in Lethal Weapon, and I was not about to shave that high and tight. So standards, if we're going to address this thing, learning loss, we need to look at the standard to say, this is what it means to demonstrate grade level proficiency in this subject, in this content area. And we need to treat our standards like a finish line. And we need to teach like a race. I talk to PE teachers. I say, when you teach running, do you just say on your mark, get set, go? And then the kids say, well, what's the finish line? Don't worry, I will let you know when you get there and cross it. No. But we do that in teaching, because if we don't pay attention to our standards, the standards are the finish line. That's where the kids need to reach and the kids need to cross. And we don't have to start at the starting line when we teach it. We need to figure out where the kids are on that pathway to proficiency. So the standard, if we use it to say, this is what you need to do to demonstrate proficiency. Can you do that? No. Okay, can you do this? No. Can you do this? Well, yeah. Okay, let's start there. So you're using your standard as the finish line, the goal, and you're using the pathway to the standard actually as a strength finder. It's the inverted RTI that Austin Buffer and Mike Maddow, the RTI at work process, where you're not identifying to say what are the services the student needs, but what do I need to do to serve the students? So you start with the standard. So I like to do this example, and I always use math because everyone gets jittery with math if I can. I say, explain why the product of a non-zero rational number and irrational number is irrational. That's a high school standard. Can you do that? No. Okay, do you know what the product of a non-zero rational number and irrational number is? No. Do you know what a product is? Yeah, that's when we multiply. Okay, so what do we have to do? Multiply. Great. See how I'm tiering it and I'm piecing it apart? And then I go, okay, what is a rational number? Kids learned that in middle school and they had learning loss. They forgot. What is an irrational number? They forgot. What does a rational mean? What does rational mean? They're not sure. What does irrational mean? They're not sure. Okay, what's a non-zero number? And they'll shout out examples. And I'm like, great, but what's a non-zero number? It's a number that's not zero. Okay, good. Let's start there. And you build their understanding back to the standard. That's what standards-driven learning is about. Our responsibility as teachers is to get the kids through the standard. It's to get the kids through. That's what it means to demonstrate proficiency. We know that they're at that grade level if they can get through the standard. Our responsiveness as teachers is to get the kids to the standard and beyond the standard. I mean, there are teachers out there like, well, I taught the standard. I don't know why they don't get it. That's your responsibility. They did their job. But how are we being responsive? Don't say, I don't have time to reteach this. You're absolutely right. But something in that child's life caused them to have learning loss. Might not have been the pandemic. Might have been their parents getting divorced. Their parents losing a job. They're being forced to move. Something in their life caused them to have learning loss. Where did they achieve that learning loss? When you say to me, these kids don't know, I say, well, what do they know? And when they say, I don't know what they know, well, go find out and come back to me and we'll start there. We need to stop looking at teaching like a deficit model. And we need to start looking at it to be a strength finder. The standard will allow that. Notice what I did. I tiered that from high school to kindergarten. And I can build people up. And you know what? I do this with adults. And when I show that standard, everyone's like, oh my gosh, you expect me to do math? In 5 to 10 minutes, they can achieve that standard if you do that. And it's not because they're adults. And it's not because they have an understanding of math. It's because they had a learning loss. They hadn't done math, some of them, in 10 to 20 to 30 years if they're not a math teacher. But I tiered it to where they are. They could tell me what a non-zero number was. And from there, we built it to what a rational number is, what makes a number irrational. And then I have them, by the end, explain to me why -3/4 times pi is irrational. Because they can say, because pi is irrational. So that's what I mean by standards-driven learning. Don't ignore your standards. It is the finish line. And don't just say, I don't teach standards, I teach students. No, you do both. Okay, you do both. You teach students the standards. And it's not what we want to teach. Because to tell you the truth, Tim, the standard will protect us. I worked with a teacher and I said, what are you teaching? And he told me foreign language. I said, what are you teaching specifically? Spanish. Okay, what's your unit? Dia de los Muertos. Okay, great. How are you going to teach it? Well, I'm going to have the kids all paint skulls on their faces. Okay, why are you doing that? And the reason why I'm asking you why is because that's what the parent is going to ask the principal, your school board, because anything you say and do these days can and will be misrepresented and misinterpreted to your administration or school board. Okay? And he says, well, I want. It's not what you want. What is your responsibility? The standard. What's the responsiveness to get the kids to and beyond the standard? You want to do that? That's great. But what if I told you there's an actual standard that allows you to do that? Because there's a standard that says, explain the customs of the culture of a target language. And that's what would allow him to do that. Because now you're saying, hey, I'm teaching the standard. You just didn't like how I taught it. Would you rather I didn't teach it that way? Yes. Okay, great. But don't tell me I'm not addressing the standard, because that is the standard.
That was perfect. And it's something, it's definitely been an important evolution in my practice over recent years. It's just understanding the importance that you just articulated there. And like you said, not just including those fun elements in the unit just because, or just because I've always done this, but understanding what that link is with the actual learning. That's so critical. That actually connects really well with my next question. And maybe you've answered this one in part, but I saw something from you that made me curious to hear more. So how should teachers respond when students ask the classic, why are we doing this? And how should we think about that question? Is it one that we need to park on each time it's asked? Or what are your thoughts?
You know what? There's two ways you can go about this. Number one, your reasoning, not your reason, not your result. When I talk about why, I'm talking about Simon Sinek's work. What's your reason? What's your purpose and what's your reasoning? Our purpose and reasoning is defined by the standard, because our purpose and reasoning is that we got to get these kids to demonstrate proficiency. That's our responsibility. Okay. Now, do you have to go into that long dialogue? No. What I used to do with my kids, because I talk about this in my first book, Now That's a Good Question. And I said, that's a good personal question, because that's one of the type of questions that kids can ask. It's a personal question. What questions do you have about this? Why do you need to learn this? Do me a favor. Go find out and let me know. And if you don't think you have to, fine. That's your argument. And I can accept your argument. Okay. But my responsibility is to get you to demonstrate proficiency, to achieve that standard. And I'm going to be responsive to help you do that and go beyond it. But you know, this is actually a great opportunity for you to let your students make that their question they want to address in your classroom. I talk a lot about things, but I want to tell a story. I had a student, he was gifted. He was brilliant, but he also suffered from other issues. He suffered from manic depression. And he was so brilliant that, you know, he never did his homework, but man, he can pass all the tests you give him. So he ends up with a D. So we move them along. So he finally gets to my class, and I asked him, I was teaching this thing about Puritanism, because I taught junior English, American literature. And I taught them and I said, what questions do you have? And the kids, I would have them come up with a question that they would want to go and ask and address on their own. And they would teach the class what they found. He said to me, why do I need to learn this? And I said, is that your question? And he said, yes. I said, okay, here's the deal. That could be your question. You can't say, I don't want to, because now we're dealing with discipline and I'm not a disciplinarian, I'm an academic. So again, he was very manic depressive and he didn't come to school a lot, but it was his day to come in and present, and he came in. Now, when he had his mania, he had this little smirk on his face. So that was when, you know, the thing I used to say in my head is that is to kind of like, you know, kind of soften, is that, you know, there, he's going to Hulk out, you know, there's Bruce Banner in the Hulk and he's like that. So he comes in and he gives this long speech about why he doesn't need to learn about Puritanism. His justification is that it's not religion, it's fear mongering and it's blind worship. And he cited examples from the sermon of Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God from Jonathan Edwards, which we had to read in class. And he talked about how that's fear-mongering, and it's not much different than what happens when people interpret religious works, misinterpret it, and may convince people that they're doing thing in God's name, but really they're not. And it portrays God more as not as a forgiving person, but a cruel person. And that's the sermon. That was my curriculum. And then he talks about Anne Bradstreet's poem, specifically how, and I'm laughing because he said all her stuff burned up, and she said, fine, I'll be reunited with in heaven with God. And he says, no, you can't just put your blind faith. You got to take responsibility. You got to get a job. You got to go get that stuff back. Everybody's looking at him in my class like he is so dead. My jaw is dropped, because for the first time in this kid's K-12 career, and he was taking my class again because he failed it the first year because he did something with a test that his great GPA didn't come out. For the first time, he did homework. For the first time, he took ownership. Not even homework. He took ownership and took his learning and took responsibility for his learning. I ran downstairs and said, I want a 504 on this kid. And I set it up and I said, the only question you have to ask, you come up with your only question you have to ask. And he says, what if I said, what do I need to learn this? I said, fantastic. If that's what you want to be your question to show that you've learned it, that's fine. Because he'll ace any basic skills, any basic test I give him. So he used to do this and he would present, and sometimes it was positive He was very happy to read The Age of Reason, the Federalist Papers. He felt other ones were a waste of time, but the kids loved to hear from him. And I had kids, like, they were asking me for a pass. Can I hear him speak? And my colleagues were like, why does everyone want to hear this kid speak? And he was so under the radar. No one knew him. And he started coming to school. He started feeling better about himself. And he actually graduated. He actually passed. He actually started attending school. So if someone says to you, class, why do you need to learn this? That's a great question. Why don't you go Google it? Go Google it. Let's see what ChatGPT has to say. Do you agree with that? Do you, you know, and a lot of times I've done that with kids and they're like, whoa, this is actually really fascinating. Are you telling me I can use the Pythagorean theorem to hit a baseball? Well, yeah. Are you telling me I can make linear equations out of, you know, football plays into linear equations? Yeah. Put it on them, because we need, when a child asks you that, they may not be an obstinate. They may be curious. I would have asked that as if I was in your class. Why do I need to learn this? And unfortunately, my teacher said to me, because. And I was like, oh, okay. So, you know, put it on the kids. Great question. Go find out. Let me know. Thank you.
Eric, as you look around education today, what else is setting you on fire?
You know, I am really looking at things not from an educator's lens, but more of a humanistic lens of, which is kind of funny. People like education's not humanistic. No, I'm doing a lot of reading that's outside of education. You've heard me mention Simon Sinek, the whole concept of why. And I'm really trying to get people to understand their reasoning and their purpose and not their reason or their result. What I mean by that is when you say, why are you doing this? And Tim, this is an interesting thing because a lot of people right now, this whole idea of being an author, professional development, it's become very lucrative. And what's happening is that the reason and the result sometimes outweighs the reasoning and purpose. Like if you think this line of work I do or this writing books and professional development is a way out, it's not. I mean, it's kind of like what Angela Duckworth says in Grit. You see what it takes to be Oprah and Michael Jordan. You don't know what happens behind the scenes to be this, to have to do this. So that's what's really getting me on fire. Is like, why are people wanting to be, you know, presenters? Why are they wanting to be authors? You know, what's your reasoning? What's your purpose? You know, kind of being serving with that. That's firing me up a lot. And lately, I just read Adam Grant's Think Again, and I have to thank Sean Galliard for recommending that to me. And that's really changed my thought process. And I really recommend that every school leader and every school teacher read that, because the whole idea is that we need to rethink, not reform, not return, not redo, not change. We need to rethink. And if you notice, I've been talking about that. There's new data and information out there about education. And this is a very wonderful time in education because everyone says, well, what's the research to support this? There's no research out there to support what do you do with children after they've gone through a pandemic, okay? So everything right now is a hypothesis. Everything is a what if. And what Adam Grant says is that we need to go and look at things and address things and look at our own learning and professional development like a scientist. And what a scientist does is a scientist comes up with a hypothesis and tests the theory and says, this is it. And then you have 10 other people who either accept it or 20 other people are going to refute it. But what makes a scientist successful is that they don't basically look at their work as gospel or law. Okay. They don't become what Adam Grant calls as preachers. Hey, this is the way to do it. They don't become prosecutors. You're wrong, I'm right. And they don't become politicians going, okay, I understand. You know, what can we do to make this better for you? You got to approach things like a scientist. That's how I'm actually coming to people right now with my professional development. And that's my mission, my word for 2024 is to rethink. I am challenging teachers to rethink depth of knowledge because what we were given is not only inaccurate, but there's new data and information, and the situation has changed about how we could use depth of knowledge. I am challenging educators to rethink how we engage in inquiry with questioning. If we're going to ask questions, then we're asking questions not just to assess, but to activate and advance learning and to understand it is uncomfortable to ask questions because we're under the pressure of answering them. So that's what's really firing me up. The other thing that's firing me up, and I'm gonna make a bold statement here. You got me kind of my pulpit now. There's a lot of behaviors that are happening right now in professional development that we professional development providers and presenters are experiencing that are very unprofessional. I mean, borderline, I cannot tell you how many people, and I'll admit this myself, cannot believe about some of the pushback. And it's not just pushback, because you've always gotten pushback, but the unprofessionalism. I mean, acting out, screaming up, you know, saying things. Some of the stuff we're getting in our evaluations, and we may get like out of 100 people, we may get two or three of them, but someone actually takes the time to say something cruel. I actually compare it to mean tweets, the Jimmy Kimmel thing. And it's like someone really took the time, because a lot of times they're not even comments, like critiques, or they're more like a personal attack. We need to stop this as educators. You know, when we come in and do professional development, we're not there to hurt you. We're not there saying you got to change. And you know what? We get it, because we wouldn't teach our kids like this. Would you teach your kids from a teacher they've never met before, and that you have 2 or 6 hours not only to learn this concept, but be masters of that concept within 2 to 6 hours, this fresh new concept? And by the time that person leaves, you got to basically not just meet the expectation, but exceed the expectation. And it's from a teacher you may never, ever see again, because we're only coming out once. Would you do that to the kids? No. So why are we doing that to the teachers? So I think what we really need to do is we need to get back to this sense of kindness. You can't ask people to be nice, because nice is a characteristic. And in some people's nature, they're not nice. You know, it might be a genetic reason, it might be an environmental reason, but we can choose to be kind. And I really want to put that out there, because there's a lot of us who are in professional development, and I'm not going to say who, but we're talking behind, you know, why are the teachers all acting this way? Why are they so angry? Why are they so mad? And it's really interesting, because it's the dynamic of teacher-student. And the joke I like to say is this, is that when the teachers go to the principal and say, I don't like that teacher, we're not coming back a lot of times. But when the kids go and say, I don't like that teacher about them, the principal says, well, you got to go and work it out. That's the thing. We get it. And the professional development I provide, it's like calculus and physics. You're not going to like it the first day. But when you work with it and you start to get familiar with it, and me as a teacher, I want to be a person who will help you and support you. That's why I set up a thing on my website after I do PD that people can they can chatbot me. They can set up a time with me, and it's all part of the PD package I give them so that it continues. But I look at it like a gym membership. Just because you have it doesn't mean, you know, you got to use it. And what's also interesting out there, Tim, is I'm actually asking school leaders this. Do we agree the kids need this? And everyone goes, absolutely. But what do we do if the teachers don't want it? And that's something we really need to look at as PD providers and leaders. What do we do when the teachers don't want the professional development that we're providing to them? Because that is not about us selling it. That's about us implementing it. We need to say, this is the direction we're going. We're going to do whatever we can do to help you out, make you feel comfortable about this. But you need to understand, this is the direction we're going. And you have to be professional. You can disagree with it, but you have to be professional. And if this is not where you want to go with things, then we may need to reconsider stuff. And that's okay, because you need to be happy too. So I guess that's what's really firing me up.
We got some fire there. I mean, I think about building leaders too, and I think it's partly on them before someone like you comes into the school or into the district. I think the building leaders have to cast the vision, have to help teachers understand, where are we going? Why are we doing, back to the why question, right? Why are we learning this? What's the end goal for students? What's the research to support this direction? And once that preloading has been put in place, I think the reception for people like you, or the appetite for learning, is going to be a whole lot different once that groundwork has been set appropriately. Well, Eric, we're starting to wind down, but I'm curious, when you think about learning, when you're not presenting, writing, doing all of the professional work that you are doing, what's another area of learning completely outside of education that continues to set you on fire?
I love learning to play guitar. I'm self-taught. I can play a bunch of tunes and put on a great concert in my office. I love, in terms of that, learning how to do that. I really, really have gotten into it. It's kind of tied into my professional, but it's also tied into personal, because I look at my personal growth. A lot of the books I'm reading now, like Simon Sinek, Adam Grant, Malcolm Gladwell. And if anyone wants to recommend some more to me, please feel free to reach out. And that's really not only helping me professionally, but it's also helping me personally to understand and to develop stronger empathy. Sometimes, I will admit, it's hard for me to see, like, hey, why can't you do this? Or why don't you want to do this? Yes, Mark, song requests are allowed. I will learn the song for you. So, so that's something that gets me excited. The other thing is this, is that I check my brain by watching YouTube, and I'll stumble upon stuff and I'm like, wow, what's that? Like, I stumble upon this thing. It's called either hostile architecture or aggressive architecture. And it's the way people design things where you're not supposed to sit down or lay down on it. And they design it in a way where you could possibly sit down or lay down on it, but it's not comfortable and you're not supposed to. So like when you see like benches that have like a little seat on it that you're not supposed to sit on it, there's enough on it, but it's not comfortable. Or they're actually doing this in New York, not a great way for the homeless to stop them sleeping on homeless grates, is they're putting these boxes and the top of the grates are curved in a way that you can't lay on it. But if you can lay on it, it then juts up into a part of your back where you don't want to lay on it. So it's actually a concept. I think also just really like trying to learn about people and trying to learn like why we are doing how we are doing what we're doing. That's kind of things that get me excited about. And for enjoyment, I just like reading for pleasure. But it's funny because you write these books for an education that I was telling you before. It's like working at a gym. You like to work out, but you don't want to go work out in a place where you work out. So like I'm reading, like I have over there on the side, like I'm like collecting all like the old Marvel and DC graphic novels that I grew up with, and I'm just reading that and just really enjoying that and really, like learning from that, because a lot of that is also like, oh, okay, well, this is why the movies are doing what they're doing. But it's also making me question, like, why don't the movies just do what they did in the books? I mean, these characters have been around for 60 years. Why are they trying, or some of them 70, 80 years now, why are they trying to deviate from that? If it worked, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. That might also be another thing we need to talk about with education. If it ain't broke and it's working, don't try to fix it, but try to figure out how we can make it better.
Eric, we are ready for our rapid fire round. Are you ready to jump in with some quick answers?
Go for it. Quick answers. I don't know if it's really quick, but like I told you, I like to talk. Like people would say, like, you sound like Robin Williams and Quentin Tarantino when you talk about education. And that's kind of how it is, because I'm very passionate, excited about it. I believe this is a profession. This is the greatest profession. So,
amen to that. Share about one phone app, personal habit, or productivity hack that contributes to your success and keeps your fire burning.
One is a language-based one, Duolingo. I'm learning Spanish through that. The other one is, it's called DDP Yoga. It was a thing created by a professional wrestler named Diamond Dallas Page. He's got a great workout program on there. I just got these things called power cuffs, and it's called blood restriction. So you put the cuffs on a point in your legs and your arms. So when you work out, it restricts a little bit of the blood. And then when you unloosen it, the blood pumps there and it really gets, the muscle going and everything. So that's really what's really, really helping me. Like, I'm learning Spanish very quickly through Duolingo, and I'm really get my exercise in using DDP Yoga. DDP Yoga, Diamond Dallas Page.
Starting at Education X, tell us about someone we should follow there and share why they've been inspiring you lately.
Okay, wow. Put one person? Well, Josh.
One person.
Okay. Oh, man, I got to give you two.
Sure.
Josh has been on your show. Josh Tovar. Yeah. I definitely would give him a shout out. Josh is such a great, not just even a great leader, but a great human, a great person. Another person is actually, she's up by you, excuse me, is Jennifer Moroz. Jennifer Moroz has really taken some things with my DOK work and made these learning progressions out of them. And she really has that why down. She really has the why down about why she's doing this. And she and I have talked about this. It's like, It's not your reason. It's not your result. It's your reasoning and your purpose. And she really has that down. So I would give her a shout out, somebody to follow on there. Check out her learning progressions. They're really good.
She's doing some great work. Shout out to you, Jennifer. Point us to an ed tech tool that you currently love using somewhere in your professional practice. This might be an app as well. Is there something that has really been saving you time or taking your work to the next level?
ChatGPT.
Yeah.
ChatGPT, totally. I will tell you this. ChatGPT helps me with communication because there's times where, you know, I get verbose and I can talk and I can sound intellectual, but I also can make these allusions to other things. And I have to sometimes say, okay, so what's a way I can explain this? And it helps me because I'll say, how do I explain this to a fifth grader? How do I explain this? I've had to explain quantum physics to a kindergartner. It's also helped me with coming up with questions. I mean, I'm good with coming up with questions in my head, but it's really good for that, good for teachers. I'm going to tell you this also, it helps with writer's block. Like when I was writing Inquiring Minds Want to Learn, I had a hard time writing about deep inquiry. And I'm like, okay, so how do I do this? How do I say this? And I use ChatGPT. Now, I don't copy and paste. And that's what we need to teach our kids. This is a starting point. It's supposed to spark the thinking. And that's what I'm going to say to teachers. Just because you got that nice little app that says DOK questions in it, don't just rely on it. Spark your creativity. So that's really been helping me a lot. I'm loving ChatGPT. Anything that makes my life easier.
Recommend one book, Eric, one that you've been reading lately, or maybe one of your all-time faves, and tell us why you recommend it.
I just finished Think Again by Adam Grant. And if we all read that as educators, teachers, humans, people, it would really, really help us understand why we do how we do what we do. And it would also help us move forward in education. You know, there's research out there that says education is not innovative, it's reformative. I believe education can be innovative. But this thing, so you notice, if you notice out there, if you go on my social media, I'm going to be saying rethink a lot. Because rethinking means I have to look at how things have changed and what the new data is, what the information is. And that's just life, guys. I mean, once upon a time, we used to wash our clothes using a washboard. Now we have washing machines. Okay. So, or once upon a time, this is actually a funny thing I say is that once upon a time, the whole world knew we were flat. They were convinced of it until Galileo came along and told us the earth is round. And when I talk to people about DOK, I present them the article Norman Webb wrote in Edutopia and said, look, here's the guy who created it. He said, don't use the DOK wheel. If you guys are going to still use that, I'm going to call you a flat earther, okay? Because basically, you're rejecting the science, okay? Don't use it. So that Think Again by Adam Grant. Everybody should read it, and I would love to have conversations about it, and I would welcome if a bunch of us who are education presenters, and if you guys want to be an education presenter, let's come together, let's put together some sort of summit, and let's all rethink education.
Are you a podcast listener, Eric? And if you are, tell us about one that we need to tune into.
Well, I got a couple. First is yours, and I'm glad I'm here. And I'm not just saying that, but you know, I reached out to you like, hey, and I'll do that. I'll boldly do that. I'll say I'd love to be on your podcast because it's just thank you for the forum and thank you for allowing me to share. So yours, Tom Shimmer's podcast, I really enjoy. What I love about Tom's podcast is the way Tom formats it. You know, I love that he talks. He used to do a thing called Don't At Me. He's not doing that as much anymore, but I used to love that. He used to be like, hey, I'm going to bring up this point. I'm going to shake the trees a little bit, which I like to do. And then he would go into an interview. I've been interviewed on it. And then he would talk about something in the assessment corner. So Tom Shimmer's podcast is really great. Elijah Carbajal's podcast is really, really good as well. And if you just want to really just talk and just mellow out, Sean Galliard's podcast too is really fun.
I see Sean is starting a new one with Sarah Candela. Look forward to that.
Yeah,
on the too. Subject of podcasts and as a support to my work, Eric, who's one educator that you would recommend I interview?
Interview Jennifer Moroz. She's up by you. She's doing great stuff. You know, I was introduced to her by Tom Shimmer. And, you know, she's really, you know, advocated a lot and done a lot with my work with DOK. The great thing about Jennifer is the humility she has with it. To say that, yes, I'm referencing other people's stuff. She referenced my stuff. She referenced Gusky's stuff. She referenced Shimmer's stuff. And she takes it and she innovates it in a way. And, you know, it's hard because sometimes in this world of social media and the way some of us present ourselves, sometimes I'm wondering if we're, you know, doing professional development with or PDing with the Kardashians, because we kind of acting more like social media brand ambassadors or content creators. We're professional developers. We're educators at heart. And she's got substance, and that's the thing. She's really good at what she does. So I'd give her a shout.
That is a strong review. Really appreciate her. Tell us about a YouTube channel. Now, I know not everyone is a YouTube subscriber, but I'm considering myself now a developing YouTuber. So is there a channel that you go to on the regular? If you don't have one, that's fine.
No, it's embarrassing to say because it's not education related. It's more like, okay. Oh. You're up in Canada, right?
Yes.
Okay. I'm a huge professional wrestling fan. I'm old school professional
gotcha.
Wrestling.
Gotcha.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, when I went to, you know, Vancouver, I was looking for the Heart Dungeon. That's the thing, you know? So I watch this thing called WrestleLamia, which gives me the news on it. I also watch some things about movies, about what upcoming movies are, especially a lot with the Marvel. I mean, I'm, as you can see probably from behind me, if you guys are looking, I'm a big fanboy. And this is just more so, I use YouTube more so to check my brain at the door and learn what I want to learn. So, and it's just really like, I just stumble on it. Like I go on my Apple TV and it gives me recommendations and I'll see stuff on there. I'll see like old videos, you know, from old shows or things like that. So there's really not like a YouTube channel per se, but I would say mostly like, you know, stuff that, you know, kind of like where I check my brain, where I can see what's the upcoming movies, watch a lot of news channels. And actually I'm a junkie on Inside Edition's news channel, which is kind of like, you know, a little higher level than TMZ. It's not gossipy. It's more like, you know, feature news and stuff like that. But yeah, so I guess that's my embarrassing thing. That's my human side of me. You know, I like to say that even professional development is a spectrum. It's funny because someone in Solution Tree always gets mad when I say this. I said, on one side of the spectrum, you got the pro, you got the professor. And on the other side of the spectrum, you got the pro wrestler knows how to work the stick. So the professor knows how to cite the research and the pro wrestler knows how to work the stick. I like to say I'm kind of in the middle because I can cite the research like Robert Marzano, but I can lay the smack down by like Dwayne the Rock Johnson. So that's the thing. And I think that also keeps you real. Like, you know, you don't come up there like a stuffed shirt, but at the same time, you're not coming up there just razzle dazzle and all spectacle. You know, you got to have some substance behind what you say.
Just for fun and closely related, Eric, what are you streaming during your downtime right now? I know last night my wife was trying to get me into the real edition of Squid Game, but is there anything you've been watching lately and enjoying?
Reacher on Amazon Prime. Oh my God. That is probably the best show that's on there right now is Reacher. Now, Reacher is a character from these books by Lee Child. Now, we know Reacher because Tom Cruise did two movies about it, Jack Reacher. Jack Reacher in the book is like 6'8" and like a Hulk, all right? Not Tom Cruise, not little soccer guy, okay? Jack Reacher is more like pro wrestler football built. Alan Ritchson on Reacher is what you think Reacher should look like and should be, and he's like perfect for the role. So I really got to recommend Reacher on Amazon Prime. If you're watching anything, you got to watch Reacher.
All right, there you have it. Eric, this has been an absolute blast. I know I'm going to learn so much even as I go through the post-production here and listen through it again. What are the best ways for Teachers on Fire to connect with you and hear more about your work?
Well, my website is Maverick, M-A-V-E-R-I-K, education.com. There's no C in Maverick. It's M-A-V-E-R-I-K. It's named after my daughters, Madison, Avery, and Amanda. And it's also my name, and I'm also a child of the 80s, big fan of Top Gun. So Maverick, M-A-V-E-R-I-K, education.com. My Twitter handle is Maverick, M-A-V-E-R-I-K-E-D-U-1-2. My Facebook and my Instagram are more personal. What I like to say is that Twitter is where I'm Maverick Education and Facebook is where I'm Eric Francis. That's where I get to be me. I mean, you've seen that, you know, so that's the best way to connect with me. And I'm going to be producing a podcast soon. I'm putting it together, getting the time. Once I get started, I'm calling it Eye of the Teacher. It's after Eye of the Tiger because we got to get the Eye of the Teacher back, that edge. Hopefully that. And again, I'm out there doing professional development. I'm out there presenting at conferences. And, you know, probably just the best way to contact me is through my webpage, maverickeducation.com. No C in Maverick.
As I mentioned earlier, Eric, I think the podcast is such a great idea. It really helps sustain and continue the conversations that you begin at these different workshops, these different visits. Eric, this has been a wonderful time, as I said. Thank you so much for sharing your time with the podcast today. Teachers on Fire, I'm your host, Tim Cavey, and I'm so grateful that you decided to spend some of your day listening to this podcast, whether it's on the audio-only platforms or here on video. I hope that in some way the content you heard today from Eric Francis sparked your thinking and ignited your practice. And I'll meet you next week right here on the Teachers on Fire podcast. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye. I never answer to no, man. I still go, go, go.